The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. I guess the first thing I'd like to do, I've been reminded by Andy to please ask you to turn your cell phones off, or if not that, to vibrate. Just wait for folks to take a seat and I'll get the introduction started. So, good afternoon. Shalom Aleichem. Salam Aleichem. My name's Steve Newman. I'm, among other things, a professor of English at Temple University. And more relevant to the talk you're about to hear, I'm a member of the Philadelphia Tikkun community, which is itself part of the network of spiritual progressives. And I'd be happy after the talk to talk with you about what that means, although Michael may himself, Rabbi Lerner may himself be mentioning what that is. So it's an honor today to introduce Rabbi Michael Lerner. Can you hear me? Am I being heard? Good. To give even a passing account of his remarkable accomplishments would take far too long, so I'll limit myself to a very few highlights. His illustrious teachers have included Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi. He received a doctorate from the University of California at Berkeley in philosophy and another doctorate in social and clinical psychology from the Wright Institute. He has written many important books that have established him as one of the preeminent spiritual and political thinkers of our time, among them Jewish Renewal, The Politics of Meaning, The Socialism of Fools, Anti-Semitism on the Left, Healing Israel-Palestine, and now, The Left Hand of God, Taking Our Country Back from the Religious Right. He is the founder and editor of the respected journal Tikkun, a bimonthly Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society, and a founder of the Tikkun community, dedicated to realizing Tikkun's interfaith message of a new bottom line for our workplaces and institutions, ecological sanity, and a compassionate and just approach to Israel and Palestine. More recently, he has helped to found the Network of Spiritual Progressives, which seeks to unite the various groups dedicated to these values and to attract new members. Finally, and last but not least, Rabbi Lerner is the rabbi of Beit Tikkun, a Jewish renewal congregation in Berkeley. To convey my own sense of Rabbi Lerner's significance, I'd like to put on my English professor's hat for a moment and quote from another big-hearted, far-seeing visionary, William Blake. Writing on prophets in an age that it's also seen revolutionary hopes dashed by both fearful reactions and bad dynamics among the revolutionaries themselves, Blake declares, "Every honest man is a prophet. He utters his opinion both of private and public matters. Thus, if you go on so, the result is so. He never says such a thing shall happen, let you do what you will. A prophet is a seer, not an arbitrary dictator." Now, Rabbi Lerner would certainly and rightly correct the masculinism of Blake's honest man, as we know there are honest men and honest women who can be prophets. But I believe he would agree with Blake's sentiments. The key point about prophecy, including the prophetic Judaism that Rabbi Lerner articulates so eloquently, is that it does not insist that a particular future must happen. Instead, it offers hope for profound, reinvigorating change, as well as a dire warning as to what will happen if we do not make that change. And I also believe that Rabbi Lerner would agree with Blake when he quotes in another text from Numbers 11, where Moses rebukes Joshua for urging him to stop other members of the Israelite camp from prophesying. And Moses said, "Would God that all the Lord's people were prophets." Or as I've heard Rabbi Lerner say, "I do not want disciples, I want allies." To this democratic hope for a prophetic vision of a better future, Rabbi Lerner weds a cogent and searching analysis of what it will take to get there. And I'll leave it to him to make that case for you. But before I turn things over to him, I want to switch hats again from professor to parent. 7 months ago, my wife and I were blessed with our first child, a daughter, Talia Rose Newman. She has given us much naches von Kinder, Yiddish for the joy that children bring. But with that joy has come the dread and the hope that all parents feel for their children. Of the many things that make me grateful for Rabbi Lerner's presence in the world, what makes me most grateful is that he and the others in the communities he's started keep energizing me to work urgently and with hope so that my daughter will live in a better nation and a better world. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for coming out this afternoon, and glad to be here and share a few thoughts with you about this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. The work that I did in making that happen took place over the course of some 29 years in which I and my colleagues interviewed, had groups of 8 to 10 weeks that, and in each group, 8 to 10 people. And they were people who were moving to the right politically. That is, not people who were the hardcore of the right, who had been with the right all along, not people who had grown up in fundamentalist families, not people who had become rich or born rich and therefore had economic interests that might be served by the political right, but rather people who were middle-income working people whose economic interests were not actually being served by the political right and who are nevertheless being moving in that direction. And so we were asking ourselves, why is this happening? Why are people who are moving to the right politically when their economic interests would lead them to support Democratic Party programs or policies? And over the course of these 29 years, we basically came to the conclusion that the reason that they were moving in that direction, based on what they were telling us in these groups, was that there's a spiritual crisis in American society, that the right speaks to it and the left does not. Now, I want to explain that in some more detail. The spiritual crisis that we learned about, first of all, came from their stories. And because we asked people to tell us about their lives and how their lives impacted on their politics. And what they said basically is this: most people spend most of their waking hours in the world of work and in travel to and from the world of work. And the way that they come to think about their lives is dramatically impacted by their experience and the way that they've come to think about the world in the world of work. And so in the world of work, people are learning day in and day out that there's a bottom line of money and power, and that if they are going to be successful they in the world of work, if they're going to keep their job even, they have to show that either directly or indirectly they can contribute to the bottom line of the place in which they work. Now, there are some people who work in nonprofit institutions and report, well, the bottom line there is extended also to the ego of the people on the top. But for most people who work on the profit sector, and for them, the bottom line is much clearer. It's about maximizing money and power. And as people learn this day after day in the world of work, this is what is counts in the real world. They are simultaneously learning how to look at other human beings through the framework of, can you be of use to me? What can you do for me that will make it possible for me to convince those who have power over my life that I can contribute either directly or indirectly to the bottom line? And of course, if I can't, then either I or maybe even my whole work unit will get downsized out of a job, or maybe the entire enterprise will be moved to Southeast Asia, to some place where those who own the corporations will be convinced that we are doing a good job in maximizing the bottom line. So all day long, I'm learning how to see other people in this way, through the framework of, can you be of use? Now, if you're in a small business person or in sales, then the way that that gets framed, the language of that, is seeing other people in terms of, well, can you be my customer? will you become a customer for me? If you're an independent professional, it's more often either, are you going to be one of my clients or patients, or at least are you going to be a referral source for me, a source to get people to come to me? But this framework of seeing other people instrumentally in terms of what you can do for me and how much you will produce for me, how you can be of use, is a framework that dominates the consciousness of people day in and day out, year in and year out, as part of the reality of the world of work. And people assured us that nothing could be done to change this. This is just how it is in the world. And if you understand the real world, they kept on telling us, you realize that there's nothing that can be done to change this. Now, what was interesting to us or striking to us was that so many people talked to us about this and told us how much they hated it, how much they wanted actually to participate in a life that had some higher meaning and purpose, that they felt that their work was stunting to them, that they wanted to have a work, some part of their work be connected to something that they would really believe in besides maximizing the bottom line. And connecting to some higher values or to connecting to the common good. At first, we didn't believe this because we had come from the world, the liberal world, the progressive world, academic and intellectual worlds, which basically have a kind of elitist view that says we, the intellectuals, or we, the progressives, we have higher meaning needs. But they, the American working class, they only care about money. Or it's summed up in the phrase that shaped the Democratic Party in the last 10 or 15 years by James Carville. It's the economy, stupid. Don't you know that all people care about is money? But actually, what we were learning was something quite different, that people felt, on the one hand, that they wanted more money, for sure. And when we asked them about that, they would say, look, I'm wasting my life anyway. So the least I can do is get some decent compensation for all these hours in the world of work where I don't believe in what I'm doing. But at least, you know, maybe when I have vacation, or maybe if I can save up enough for retirement in my retirement years, I can do something that I really believe in, because right now I feel like I'm wasting my life. This notion of a purpose-driven life has become popularized in the last few years when this right-wing Reverend Warren wrote a book called A Purpose-Driven Life, and it sold 25 million copies, and it sort of validated what we had been learning all along, that people were desperately hungry for some framework of meaning and purpose for their life that would transcend the dynamics of the marketplace. But as I say, at the same time that people felt that way, they came home feeling like, and there's nothing I can do to change it, feeling miserable about that kind of work situation and feeling there's nothing I can do to change it, and that, in fact, to be realistic, I have to go and teach my kids how to similarly learn how to maneuver in the real world. And what have I learned? Well, in the language of the people that we were talking to, what they summed it up this way. It's all about looking out for number one. It's all about looking out for number one and recognizing that nobody's going to watch your back. Nobody's going to be protecting you unless they, too, can get certainty that somehow or other in the deal you'll be watching out there, looking out for their back and protecting them equally. So this consciousness then brought home into personal life creates tremendous difficulties for people. It creates difficulties, number one, in that the most significant complaint that people have about their daily life experience is, I feel like alone. I feel like I don't know who I can count on. I don't know who I can trust anymore. It looks to me like everybody is just out for themselves. And this is not a paranoid perception. This is the recognition that that it's not just this particular person, but all people in the world of work are learning and internalizing this market consciousness and understanding looking out for number one is the common sense, and or as the more sophisticated ones told us, hey, you know, what it is to be rational in is to be a maximizer of self-interest. Look out for number one, maximizer of self-interest. So how does this affect daily life, besides the feeling of being alone and not knowing who you can count on? Well, it directly affects friendships, because many people report that friendships are increasingly today more based on a kind of exchange relationship. I give to you on the reasonable expectation that you'll give back an equal amount of time and energy to me. What's the problem there? The problem is that people used to feel that there was an element of solidarity, so that even when you got sick or when you got older and you weren't able to give back an equal amount of time and energy to the other, that the other was still there for you. But today, without that element of solidarity, when it's just an exchange relationship, as people get older or as people get sick, they report that they feel like many of their friends aren't there as much for them as they used to be. And they feel like something is wrong with them about that, but they just feel like there's something gone wrong, gone amiss. And they remember a time in the past when friendships had a stronger element to them, and friendships feel thinner today, less like you can really count on them because of this, the degree to which people have internalized this market consciousness. And secondly, in the world of relationships, more and more we find a dating world which is shaped by these kinds of dynamics, in which people almost see each other as though they were products in a supermarket, in which they taste one and then they may chew that one over for a few months and then go to another and then to another. And the dating world has that quality increasingly of people being involved with one experience and then another experience and then another experience, in which the goal is to have as many interesting experiences as possible, and to see the other person primarily through the framework of, what can you do for me? Make something happen that's interesting. Make something happen that'll excite me. Deliver something for me. Well, as people spend more and more time in this dating world, they become more and more cynical about who other human beings are, because they're meeting more and more people who are looking at them that way, namely, what can you do for me? Can you, how can you make my life more interesting? Show me something. Do me something. And they themselves have that same attitude. So what happens is they're meeting people who are reconfirming for them the notion that everybody is just out for looking out for number one, taking care of themselves. So when people eventually do make commitments, it's often, now to translate this language into the language of psychologies of relationships, people say, well, what am I looking for in a relationship? I'm looking for somebody to take care of my needs. Okay, and I'm going to make a commitment. And what's the commitment mean? A commitment means that amongst the people who are likely to fall for me in the short run, you will satisfy more of my needs than anyone else. Therefore, I'm committed to you. And this becomes increasingly the basis for loving relationships and marriages. And as that increasingly becomes the basis for marriages, more and more people feel insecure in their marriages. And I should say not just the 50% of marriages that end in divorce, but also the other 50%, because you're never sure which of the two categories you're in. And because another way of putting that is because you know if you respect your partner at all, and he or she is now in the world of work, that the chances are that she or he is also learning what you've learned, namely to be a rational maximizer of self-interest, to look out for number one. And consequently, it's very you're never sure that your partner won't at some point in her life or his life be able to cut a better deal. That is to say, find somebody who will satisfy yet more of their needs than you can, either really or at least in their fantasy, that this other person will satisfy more of their needs. And then, as a rational maximizer of self-interest, of course, they're going to do that. So now how upset you are about this, partly, of course, faced with, is based on individual psychological factors. Everybody's going to be upset somewhat if you've been involved in a relationship for more than a few months, and certainly if you've been involved in a relationship for 10 or 15 or 20 years and have your partner leave you, it's going to be rather significant trauma. But how long that trauma lasts and how disastrous it is, how much people fear it even when your partner hasn't left, is partly affected by individual psychological factors, but also by one's own calculation of one's own marketability. Because the younger you are, the financially more secure you are, the more conventionally attractive you are, the more you're thinking internally, yeah, I'm marketable anyway. I'll find somebody else. But the older you are, the less conventionally attractive and the less financially secure, the more living in this kind of a society where everybody, where half the families are breaking up and where there's, when you turn on television, every single interaction in every sitcom has as its premise the assumption that each person is just looking out for herself or himself, maximizing their own self-interest. And what's funny is the way that they're doing it with each other and but that fundamentally, that's what every relationship is about. When you're surrounded by this and you feel like you're not so marketable, it can be, in fact, traumatic to live in that society because you're feeling more and more scared that it could happen to you. So now, I don't want to in any way here, I'm not here to judge anybody. I myself have been divorced. I'm not in any way trying to put anybody down who's been in these dynamics. On the contrary, I believe my point is that it's almost impossible to grow up in this society and not have internalized market consciousness. But I say almost because there is another consciousness, and it's what we call a spiritual consciousness. Spiritual consciousness is one in which we look at other human beings not from the standpoint of will you be attractive if you go out with me? You know, if I take you to my friends and whatever, would that raise my esteem in their eyes? Will you be charming for my boss or my work unit? Will you be a good house person or a good a parent to my children or a good earner or whatever? That is not in terms of what you can do for me, but seeing other human beings primarily in terms of them being embodiments of the sacred, fundamentally valuable just for who they are, not for what they can do for you. If that seems too religious a language for you, seeing other human beings from the standpoint, well, Martin Buber said, I-thou relationship rather than an I-it relationship. Or if that still sounds too mystical to you, then maybe Immanuel Kant's language. I mean, he said, see the other as a subject and not as an object. But whatever, however you want to language this, this is a spiritual consciousness. It's a way of seeing human beings not through the frame of what can they do for you, but rather through the frame of them being fundamentally valuable in and of themselves. And the spiritual crisis that I talk about in this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, this is, the spiritual crisis has two elements. Number one, that a very large and increasing number of people in our society feel that they are only seen through the framework of, can you be of use? That is, or another way of putting this is, they're only seen instrumentally or from a utilitarian standpoint, that other people all around them are looking at them and only seeing them in terms of how can they be of use to the other people? What can they do for you? Not only just strangers, but also your own friends, your spouse, your children, everybody looking at you through this frame. And so another way of putting this is increasing numbers of people feeling that they are not being recognized for who they are. They're only being seen for what they can do, for what they can deliver for you, how they can be of use to this person or that person or the other person. And people have these complaints about their families, and they have their complaints about their friends, and they have the complaints about everybody in their life. They feel misrecognized. And then on the other hand, these same people who feel lonely and not really seen in their personal lives and in their family lives are simultaneously living in the world of work in which they have little opportunity to connect to their highest values and to be able to feel that their life is about something that they can believe in. These two elements constitute the spiritual crisis of American society. And the political right in this country gained tremendous credibility by articulating this, by saying there's a spiritual crisis, and that spiritual crisis is rooted in the ethos of selfishness and materialism. Now, the terrible thing about this is that the right is correct about this, and that it then goes on to blame this on the demeaned others of the society. And this is the universal formula. Wherever you find right-wing movements or ultra-nationalist movements, they will talk about the spiritual crisis or the crisis of values or however they formulate it, all these two elements that I'm just talking to you about. And then they will say, and the reason for that is, and they point to whoever happens to be the demeaned others of the society. So, for example, in Europe, in the 20th century, it was primarily the Jews who were the demeaned others. And consequently, when German fascism or French fascism or Italian fascism or Polish fascism arose, they said, you know, we'd have a great society here except for these Jews. The Jews are introducing selfishness. They just care about themselves. They don't care about anybody else. And all they care about is money. They're looking out for themselves. Now, in the United States, the primary demeaned other has historically been African Americans and Native Americans. And so they received the brunt through most of the history of American nationalism. They've received the brunt of the attack from these kinds of right-wing movements. But in the last 30 years, the right in its magnanimity has extended the category of who is to be the demeaned other so that it now includes, first of all, feminists, namely those women who sought to rectify a long history of oppression of women over the course of the past 10,000 years by challenging the sexism and patriarchy. And what the right then does is say, see, they're just out for themselves. They're looking out for themselves. That's where you want to understand why values are getting eroded in the society. It's these uppity women. They're just looking out for number one. In other words, they abstract that from the context of the previous history of denial of women's rights, and then and when women are trying to rectify the imbalance, they say, ah, this is selfishness and materialism on their part. Or gays and lesbians. Now, you might say, why gays and lesbians? Well, what the right says is they're not raising children, which, by the way, is not true. Many, many gay and lesbian families today are raising children. But nevertheless, what they say is they're just having sex for the fun of it, and it's not fair because the rest of us have sex, and we have to raise kids out of this process. And those people don't raise kids. So you see, it's obvious that the undermining of our value structure is coming from these gays and lesbians as well, because they're not involved in raising the next generation. They're not suffering like the rest of us, and they're out for themselves. Okay, they're just getting pleasure. And in the last 5 years, they've extended this to now include all liberals, all secular people. And in the last 2 years, also activist judges. Okay. Anyway, this is their analysis. Now, meanwhile, the irony here is that the right is the primary force in the society that is the force that champions the ethos of selfishness and materialism in the world of work. Because in the world of work, they are the force that continually fights against every attempt to introduce social responsibility, whether that's a living wage for workers, whether that's attempts to create safety and health regulations at the workplace, whether that's to attempts to regulate the products so that they will be safe for the consumers, whether that's attempts to regulate the environmental impact of the way that they're producing their goods so that while they're producing their goods, they don't destroy our environment. Whenever it is, the right is out there championing the corporations and saying that the best thing for the whole society is if there are no restrictions on corporations so that they can maximize their own profits to the highest level possible, and then that will trickle down to everybody else, and everybody else will be better off that way. So you might ask, now how do they get away with this? Here they are, the force that in the public world, and they don't deny that they're doing this, this is their explicit philosophy that the best good for all will be served if government is downsized so that there are no restrictions on corporations or have only very, 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 very limited restrictions on corporations to pursue their own self-interest. Now, so here they are, the champion of self-interest in the world of work where most people spend most of their waking hours. And then when people come home from the world of work, having learned this ethos of selfishness and materialism that is the bottom line of the world of work, the right positions itself also as the articulator of the pain that people feel when what they've learned all day in the world of work is brought home and causes pain, as it inevitably will, in personal life. So how do they get away with working both sides of the street? Well, the answer is they get away with working both sides of the street because the left isn't even in the relevant ballpark. The left doesn't have a clue about the spiritual crisis. The left only understands and only has as its primary focus the struggle for inclusion into the political rights and the material well-being of the society. Now, let me make it clear. I'm totally with the left on these issues. I totally want the left to win in terms of achieving equal rights for everybody and achieving inclusion of everybody in the material well-being of the society. But the left isn't winning, and it won't win because for a very large segment of Americans, the primary issue is not their economic deprivation or their deprivation of rights. Or at least it's not only that. It's not only that. There is another dimension to human needs, which is what I've been talking about. And it is that people feel a spiritual deprivation. They feel a deprivation of recognition and a deprivation of meaning in their lives. And it is the right that positions itself as the articulator of that pain, and the religious right in particular, that says, come into our communities and you will find meaning and purpose here. And it's not your fault that you're not finding meaning in work and that you're surrounded by selfishness. These are real problems, and they're generated by the selfishness of these other groups and the way that they have organized the society. And they've organized the society in ways that will make you feel terrible, and we can reorganize the society in ways that will make you feel a lot better about your lives and, in fact, provide you with communities in our religious right churches and find you and provide you with a different ethos if we can just throw those liberals out of power and rebuild the society on the basis of our particular Christian vision. Now, what I want to say here is you can't fight that with another highway program. You can't fight that with a new economic entitlement. You can only fight that if you have an alternative spiritual vision, a progressive spiritual vision. But unfortunately, the left doesn't have that. It doesn't even have the relevant intellectual categories to develop that. And that's why there needs to be something new. And that something new is what we're calling the network of spiritual progressives, which we are building around the country. The co-chairs with me of this network are Cornel West, professor of African American Studies and Religious Studies at Princeton, and Benedictine sister Joan Chittister. And we're building a national organization and a new movement. It's a spiritual movement, and it has three main points. Number one, to challenge the misuse of God by the religious right. And there we talk about, in the book, I talk a lot about the way in which the vision of God as a power or force over other people, which is one of the voices of God in both the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, and in the New Testament, has been misused by the right, because when that voice is there, I call it the right hand of God, because in the Torah, after the children of Israel get out of slavery, they sing a song to God on the other side of the sea, Miriam and the children of Israel, and they say, your right hand, God, your right hand is filled with power. But this vision of power that is there in the text is a vision that is almost always, in fact, always used to associate with the powerless who cannot envision how they can overcome the empire of, for example, Pharaoh, or in the New Testament, overcome the empire of Rome. And then the prophets and come forward and say, well, there's this God that has power, and that power can be used to empower the powerless. But what we've seen is an inversion by the religious right in this country, in which that vision of God is now handed over to the powerful, who use it to justify cutting their own taxes and cutting social programs for the poor and supporting military adventures around the world to dominate and control the world. In other words, instead of understanding that this vision of God was meant to empower the powerless, This is being used to empower the powerful to dominate the powerless, a total inversion of what the Bible was about. So one thing that we're about is challenging the misuse of the Bible by the religious right. The second thing we're about is challenging the religiophobia or insensitivity to spiritual life in the left. Because one of the things that we learned in this, in the interviews we did with middle-income working people, was that there is a culture that they personally experienced in the liberal world in which anybody who really takes God seriously or really takes spirituality seriously is put down. Now, don't get me wrong here. You can be sure that in 2006 election, 2008 election, every Democratic Party candidate is going to be quoting Bible or talking about their last week's experience in church. But nevertheless, in the culture around the left, there is a put-downish quality to people that people experience if they're into God or if they're into religion or even into forms of spiritual practice that aren't God-related. And that people tell us about this all the time as one of the things that pushed them away from being identified with the liberal culture. They felt that they were being condescended to, that there was a culture there that basically thought that they're at a lower level of intellectual or psychological development if they believed in any of that stuff. And so they were welcomed in, but they should leave their baggage at the door, the religious and spiritual baggage at the door, that we need your vote, but we don't, basically we think you're at a lower level than us. Maybe you've got an authority issue that you haven't worked out. That's why you believe in God. Or maybe you're an escape from freedom. You're scared to make decisions of your own, and so that's why you're into God. But basically, the message that people hear over and over from the left is, if you're not with us, the main reason you're not with us is because you're stupid. This is not an endearing strategy for winning people over. And yet it's heard so frequently by people, and they told us. And you know, there are many levels of this. When I was giving this talk last week in Seattle, a woman came in the question period said, you know, this just happened to me this week, there's this guy I'm sort of interested in. He called me up and asked me to go for a walk on Sunday morning. I said, I'm not available. I'm going to church. He said back to me, seemingly totally shocked, what? I thought you were a Democrat. Maybe it's not always as crude as that, but there is, but this is a real story. I didn't make this up. This happened just last week. Okay, so there is a culture around the left that makes people feel unaccepted here if they are into religion or into spirituality, such that except if they're third world. In other words, and here again, a kind of paranoid, patronizing view. Well, yeah, the third world, they're allowed, you know, if you're a person of color, you're allowed to do that. But if you're not a person of color, then there's something really off with you. Of course, total insensitivity on the one hand, and also a total lack of understanding that the left was never stronger in this country in the last 50 years than when it was being led by Martin Luther King Jr., whose demonstrations started, every single demonstration, starting in a church with a church rhetoric and moving out into the public sphere. Now, don't get me wrong here. We're not asking that everybody become religious or that everybody develop a spiritual practice. That's not what we're asking. We're asking for people to create a space that gives place to people with respect who have a different orientation towards the world than the dominant secularism that you find in the left. The third element of the network of spiritual progressives is that we are calling for a new bottom line in America. And by this we mean a new definition of productivity, efficiency, and rationality, so that institutions are judged efficient, rational, and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power, but also to the extent that they maximize love, caring, kindness, generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacities to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacities to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. This is a very different way of understanding, and it transcends the old left-right dichotomies. It's a new bottom line. And another way of putting this is, it's a new way of saying what counts. And if the left, if the liberal and progressive forces, that is, the Democratic Party, the social change movements, the Greens, all those forces, were to begin to articulate a politics within this discourse and with this new bottom line, it would be a very different kind of politics, and it would be one that would quickly win back very large numbers of people who have been pushed away from the left. So this is our orientation. And in the book, The Left Hand of God, I lay out a spiritual covenant with America that says exactly how this would translate into political programs. I'll give you one quick example, and that is the one about foreign policy and homeland security, which basically what I say there, and this is, we're bringing this 8-point program to Washington May 17th to 20th, and I'd like to invite you to come with us to Congress to meet with elected representatives and talk about this new framework for politics at our spiritual activism conference that we're holding at the All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C. Okay, there's another one, right? That's right. All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C. But here's an example of one such. We're saying that the most effective way to end, to deal with homeland security and to, is to take, for the United States to take the leadership in convincing the other G8 countries to do this, but first the United States doing it by example, taking 5% of our gross domestic product for each year of the next 20 and dedicating that to eliminating global poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care, and repairing the ecological damage to the planet. That move by itself would bring far more homeland security and far more effective defense of the United States than the trillions of dollars that we are sinking each year into a military budget that has that far from enhancing our security actually undermines it. So this is an example of what we're talking about when we're talking about a new bottom line. And this new bottom line stems from another philosophical perspective, and that is a deep recognition that is a spiritual recognition that is you do not hear articulated by the liberal or progressive forces today, but ought to be, that our well-being as Americans depends on the well-being of everyone else on the planet. Or another way of putting it is that there is only one of us here on the planet, that we are all one, that there is a unity of all being, that there is a oneness of all, that there is no rational way in the 21st century to understand our lives as separate from the well-being of everybody else and of the planet itself. We are all intrinsically connected, and there is, and so we want to see the day when the President of the United States says, God bless the people of the United States and every other people on the planet. In other words, equally affirming that. And this is a spiritual consciousness to recognize the unity of all being and the oneness of all with all. And it is a recognition that is the only way the people of this planet will survive in the 21st century. And it is critical that since you do not hear this being articulated by the Democrats or by the liberal forces, that there be a spiritual politics that can articulate it. Well, look, there's a lot more in my book, The Left Hand of God, than I've mentioned here. I'm here in part to urge you to join this network of spiritual progressives. You can find us on the web at www.spiritualprogressives.org. You can, for those who are ready to join today, I have a flyer here that you can sign up and give us a check or a credit card if you get it, if you really want to move on this. I'm here to tell you that that we could fundamentally change the society, but it's going to require you coming out of the closet as spiritual beings. What do I mean by that? I mean, stop living a life in which you let others tell you what's realistic and then shape your politics according to what's realistic. Instead, start articulating your highest goal for the world. Come out of the closet and begin to adhere to and articulate your own vision of the good. That's what this new bottom line is about. And if you do that, you will find that there are millions of other people who didn't know that you were there and you didn't know that they were there, who will respond to a language of love and caring and generosity and kindness, who will not respond to the language of the liberal left any more than we could respond to the language of the liberal right, but who would respond to a different kind of vision. So I urge you to get the book. I urge you to join the organization. Help us make this happen. It could happen, and if it does happen, American politics could be fundamentally transformed in a way that would make it possible to save this planet from the ecological destruction that is almost certainly facing all this world if we don't move in that direction. Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to do some questions and answers now, and if you want to ask something, raise your hand, and one of the people will bring you a microphone. Don't ask until you get a microphone in your hand. Okay, well, I can't hardly see. If somebody could turn off those lights, that particular set of lights, yeah. Okay. Anybody want to ask anything? Okay.
Your comments, would you identify 2, 3, 4, any number of political leaders that you think are receptive and embracing the message that you just outlined?
No, I won't, and I'll tell you why. There are a lot of people who whisper in my ear, "Oh, Michael, I really agree with you. Rabbi Lerner, I've been reading Tikkun all these years. It's terrific. Rabbi Lerner, I'm right behind you, way behind you." You know, I had this for those of you who are readers of Tikkun, are there any people in the room who are readers of Tikkun? Oh, great. Okay, good to see you. Those of you who followed Tikkun know that in the 90s, I was being described by the media as the guru of the White House, and in particular, Hillary Clinton's guru. And there was a full-page story about me in the Washington Post, and and the New York Times had a 5-page magazine story about me, and all this based on how great power I had in the White House. Well, I can tell you, while the stories were wildly inflated, it was true that Hillary was quoting my ideas, and that Bill was quoting my ideas, and often quoting my editorials word for word. But the influence was wildly exaggerated. And the truth of the matter is that when it came down to it in policy terms, when I asked them, well, why don't you actually then do something about this? Their answer was, there's no movement out there. So we're by ourselves and we're scared. And I said, but you're the president. And what I got back was, yeah, but there's nobody out there to support us. And so the only thing we can do is play by the rules here. And until we feel that there's some... And Hillary once told me this story about when FDR met with the labor movement about the Lehman Act in 1934, and they tried to convince him to support the Lehman Act, which would have legalized unions in organizing, which eventually he did and passed. But he met with them for 4 hours, and at the end he said, "You know, you've totally convinced me. Now go out there and force me to do it." Do you know what he was saying? He was saying, "You've got my head intellectually, but until I see a political force out there that I can turn to the insiders here who are saying it's not in my interest and say, yes, it is, because there's that force out there." So that's the reason I'm not going to mention political leaders, because basically when there's a movement, they will run to the front of it and say, "I always agreed with this." And when there isn't a movement, they will whisper in my ears about how much they love my ideas and will not get out there in front of it. So that's what I've been encountering. Now, we're going to go to Washington. I hope some of you will come with us, the May 17th to May 20th. May 18th will be the day that we're meeting with congressional people. We'd love to have people here that can go and meet with Chaka Fata and other whoever are your representatives here, to talk about these ideas. They're not going to move until they feel like there's something beneath them. So that's why I don't want to out any of the people who have been whispering in my ears, because I don't think that it would be in their interest or my interest to do that, because they're not going to say yes. They're probably going to say, I don't know what he's talking about, or whatever. There's nobody out there at this moment who is ready to embrace this. Embrace it publicly and in a full way. Yeah.
Book, it seems to me you're talking about primarily about the Democratic Party, and there are people in the forefront, be it Medea Benjamin, be it Leslie Kagan, even now Cindy Sheehan, and a young woman called Rachel Corrie, who's no longer with us. And not too long ago, Michael Moore talked about the Republicrats. And I'm wondering why you focus the degree that you do on this old party called the Democrats.
Well, first of all, I want to say that we're not a sectarian organization. The Network of Spiritual Progressives thinks that the Greens or the Republicans or the Democrats or whatever party you're in would benefit from the spiritual consciousness, any party. And so we are advocating for people, for example, in the Greens, we'd like to see a spiritual caucus form there of people who would advocate for this new bottom line there. If you're a Democrat, then we'd like to see you go into the Democratic Party and create a spiritual caucus in the Democratic Party to advocate there. We're a 501c3. We're a nonprofit organization, and we're not allowed to be advocating for any particular party. And we use the example of Democrats because most of the people who are reading the book are Democrats, and that most of the people who see themselves as threatened by the religious right are Democrats. But there are a lot of other people who aren't. And we're not telling people, hey, be in this party or that party. We're saying whatever party you're in, if you want to change the liberal and progressive forces in this society, you've got to articulate a spiritual vision. And I'd love to see that happen in the Greens. If the Greens were taking the forefront of that, it would be a lot more logical for us to be emphasizing, hey, here's an example of a party that's doing it. I haven't seen that happen in the Greens yet, but I'd like to see it happen. I'd like to see it happen in the Democratic Party, and I'd even like to see some group of people do this in the Republican Party, because I think that they could precipitate a split, because I think that there are some decent, good people in the Republican Party. And that's actually, this is one of the points that I'm making in the book, really, is that it's very important for us to understand that the people who disagree with us are also decent and good people. Yeah, there's some scumbag there, but there's some scumbags that I've met on the left, too. So, I mean, instead of starting from the assumption that everybody who supports policies that I find offensive and immoral are themselves offensive and immoral, I want to distinguish between policies that I hate and people who are fundamentally decent. Do you understand what I'm saying here? Because it's a hard one for us to get, because it's so much easier for us to want to say, they're bad, we're good. But I'm saying to you, first of all, it's not true. But secondly, it's not smart. It's not smart to think that way, because it doesn't lead to building a movement that could actually change the dynamics of the society. It's a tough one, isn't it? It's hard to get that and say, well, are you telling us that we have to think about Rick Santorum, that he's a decent human being? I'm not saying that. No, I'm not going that far. I'm not talking about the hardcore. I'm talking about a significant section of people who have moved to the right. That's the ones I know about, okay? Tens of millions of Americans who used to be Democratic Party voters who are now not. That's whom I'm talking about. And I'm not saying for sure I know that the others aren't, I'm saying I don't know. I haven't studied them. I have studied, we had in this study was one of the largest studies ever done of American working class consciousness. There are 10,000, we had over 10,000 people in this study, very widely representative of America, and a lot of decent, good people who are moving to the right. Okay, anyway, I hope that partly answers. Yeah.
Yeah, I would maintain that a lot of people on the left are there for very spiritual reasons, and that their dedication to left-wing politics is a belief in the worth of all humanity, the value of peace and the care of the world and that sort of thing. So I have difficulty with the notion that it's bereft of spirituality. It seems to me that the real issue is more the failure to express the beliefs that underlie those positions on the part of the left. And whether you call them spiritual or humanistic or whatever you label them, it seems to me that that's where the failing has been, rather than in the presence of a consciously spiritual movement within the left. Mm-hmm. And I would like your comments on that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I entirely agree with you. Okay, that is to say, a good part of what we're doing is trying to create a unifying framework that can articulate our highest values. However, that those values are should not just be in terms of economic entitlements and rights. They should also be about love and caring and generosity and kindness. And those are what I'm talking about when I'm talking about spiritual values, because I very rarely hear that being discussed or fought for in the left. In other words, I very rarely see, here's a typical example I use in my my own life. When I was, before I was a rabbi, I would go around to different congregations and see how they were. So I'd go to Reform and Conservative or Reconstructionist places, and I often would hear sermons that were wonderful. Then after the service, nobody paid attention to me. I was alone, and I'd go home. And that was it. I went to Orthodox services, and I couldn't stand what I heard. The sermons felt to me to be racist or chauvinistic or whatever. I mean, I couldn't stand them. After the service, people came up to me and wanted to know if I had a place to eat, if I had anybody who was in the hospital who needed to have a visit, if there was any issues in my life was I single? Maybe I'd like to meet a woman. We laugh at those kinds of things, but they are nits and grits of what it was to be caring about somebody. Okay. I never experienced that in left organizations. People always, in the more liberal side, they always had the right line on issues, but they never paid that much attention to caring about each other and never had that as a real value in which they used that as an assessment of, was this a good meeting? Meaning, not did we have some smart talk here, but did everybody here feel like they were part of a caring entity and that they were being cared for? So whereas I want to say to you, yes, I already agree with you that there are deep value commitments on the part of the left that need to be articulated, and if they were articulated better, we would be much more successful, and that we have to extend those from the frame of justice and rights to also include love and caring and kindness and generosity. Is there a woman? Is there any woman that? Because I think we've got. Okay, great.
Hi, I just wanted to know. You talked about the 5% of the GNP as a goal. What is the current level of spending for?
I had this in my book, but I'm totally blocking on the figure now that you asked me. But the current level of of aid to those to other countries. It's about 0.2%. In other words, 1/5 of 1% of our GNP is our current level. And that's including a vastly disproportionate amount of aid to a few countries that we consider militarily critical to us. Way back there, all the way in the back. The guy with the hat? Yeah. Or is it a woman with a hat? I can't see that far.
If I was a woman, I'd have a pretty hairy face.
Okay. I can't see that.
My question is this. Anthropologists have studied world cultures, and it seems that before the world got small, the dispersion of people all around it, these small communities and everything else, they've discovered that almost universally that there was a spiritual world, a belief in God, okay? And it's almost the fact that, like, you would think that if we had a time machine, we could bring back, you know, people from like 10,000, 50,000 years ago, and if you could educate them, there's no difference in their muscularity and the size of the brain. They could fit into this culture. And it's like, okay, we understand that through science and everything else, we have a better interpretation of our natural laws. And it's like we've somehow demystified the spiritual life or God. And my own experience has been like, I'm a recovering drug addict. So I needed some type of belief system. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that, like, it didn't matter what I called it, that through my experience over the years, there actually is a spiritual force. Okay? Now, I can understand specifically why people, you know, aren't readily, you know, believing in God the way their parents did or the way they were brought up. But it's almost the fact that, like, no one talks about it. Mm-hmm. Do you, I mean, this may seem like a really stupid question, but do you believe in God? Do you have an experience of a higher power?
Yes, I definitely do. No, let me clarify this, and then I'm afraid I'm going to have to go upstairs to sign books. Because unfortunately, I have at 1:30, I have a radio interview, and I have to go to that. So I want to meet people who. So two things to say. Number one, yes, I believe in God, and I'm a rabbi, and I lead services every week in my synagogue in San Francisco, and I'm deeply committed to that. But the organization, the network of spiritual progressives, is not only for people who believe in God or who are religious. It is also for people who are spiritual but not religious. In other words, many of the people in our organization are, say they're atheists or agnostic in relationship to God, but they recognize that there's a spiritual dimension to human reality or to human needs. And they recognize that this is a fundamental need and that it can't be relegated to just the weekend. It needs to be articulated in the public sphere. Now, if you look again there are many unanswered questions right now in your mind. If you read the book, you'll find that point number 8 of the 8-point spiritual covenant is about separation of church and state, for which we strongly believe in and fight for. So, we want to bring spiritual values, not God, but spiritual values into the public sphere. So our organization, though I personally am somebody who believes in God and has had that experience and so forth, we are not a proselytizing organization trying to convince people to have spiritual experiences or to believe in God. On the contrary, as I say, we have an equal number almost of people who are spiritual but not religious or spiritual but don't believe in God. We're creating a union between these two groups, between progressive religious people and progressive spiritual people who don't believe in God but do recognize the centrality of spiritual needs. Now, having said that, I just want to say one last thing before I rush up to see. I came here not to get fans, but to get allies, okay? The movement that we're building isn't like, I'm not some, you know, Indian guru or whatever, you know, coming to have people read my book and period. I'm actually interested in building a movement, and I want to find if there are any people here who want to be my allies and work. There is already a small group of people in Philadelphia who are trying to create the network of spiritual progressives here. I'd like you to join the organization, upstairs we'll also have some sign-up lists, yes? If you just want to give us your email so that we know how to contact you. But if you actually want to help, and please join the organization. You can join it today with a check or with a credit card. And help us make this real. So if there are people here who want to be my ally and work with me on it, I want to meet you. Others, if we run out of books, I don't know if we'll have enough books or I'm not sure how many, please get the book. If you get turned on to it, create a study group with other friends. You'll find that the book is much deeper than anything I said here. I was giving a vulgar presentation. After all, it was just a few minutes that I had to talk to you. The book is much more sophisticated and nuanced than I've been. But as I say, the one point that I won't be nuanced on is we can change this world, but we have to go for it and not just wait for something to happen. It won't happen unless we make it happen. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and please join us upstairs for the book signing.
Michael, we're going to take you right out back.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.